This is the 2020-2021 Child Health and Advocacy Experience podcast. This is a four-part educational series produced by pediatric residents for pediatric residents. The focus of this series is on race, racism, and health equity. The topic for today is health disparities with asthma.
Hi, my name is Gina Jung, and this is my story.
Hi, I'm Alex Young.
And I'm Lewis Peterson, and we are all pediatric residents.
And I have a story to tell Alex, Lewis, and our listeners.
Okay, Gina, we're ready.
So, I have a patient, I'll call him Mason, and he is a 4-year-old black male with asthma. He was hospitalized for the first time a year ago, and it was pretty bad. He was admitted to the ICU on BiPAP and IV steroids. He left with an albuterol inhaler and a controller steroid inhaler, and we were hoping that that was all he'd need. Since then, he's been admitted 3 times, so often that it feels like all the residents know him.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, so now he classifies as having severe persistent asthma, and he has a high-dose controller steroid inhaler and multiple medications for his allergies, too.
Wow.
Yeah, most of Mason's doctors think that his main problem is non-compliance. The wards teams and his pulmonology team are always asking his mom if she actually gives him his medicines and actually follows the asthma action plan. His pulmonologist even calls the pharmacy to make sure that his inhalers actually get filled.
Do you think that's really what's going on? Non-compliance?
Well, during his last hospitalization, his pulmonologist told me that she quizzed him and his mom, and he was refusing to use his inhalers. So eventually, after he was discharged, you know, his mom was really upset, and she came to the clinic to see me a couple days later.
What'd she say?
So she said, he refuses his inhaler 1 time, when at home he always does it right, and then the pulmonologist assumes he's been doing it wrong the whole time. She said it was so upsetting that people were assuming she was doing things wrong and not taking care of him well. She said she was upset because she was trying so hard, but he's still so sick. And she felt like a bad mom.
Yeah, I feel like this conversation about race is something that has been coming up so much lately. And just this question of whether the mom is being treated differently because of her race and because of the race of her child and what they look like. And I remember in medical school, so much of the way we were taught about all of these diseases and different conditions, race was always a part of the discussion. Which ethnicities will do worse with this particular prognosis or with this disease, or which people get it more often? And I never questioned it because you're in med school and you're just absorbing all of the information like a sponge. But now looking back, especially this year, I feel like I have to go through everything with a fine-tooth comb and make sure the way race was included in my education, in my brain, in my understanding of medicine really makes sense and isn't just racism at play in how we practice medicine and how I was taught and how they were taught before me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't help but think that there's more to it, you know, like and how race affects asthma specifically. And maybe we were taught all those things in med school and even a little bit in residency, but we shouldn't accept them at face value. Maybe we just need to dig a little deeper and find out why that health disparity exists, and then maybe we can do something about it.
My name is Greg Rodden. I'm a second-year resident at Dell Children's, and...
And my name is Anusha Chintaparthi. I'm a third-year resident at Dell Children's.
And we are lucky to be here with a fantastic, fantastic Dr. Elizabeth Matsui. Would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm happy to. So I'll give just sort of a little bit of a snippet. So I'm a pediatric allergist immunologist. And while I was doing my fellowship in allergy immunology, I got a master's of health science in epidemiology. And so I see patients about 10% of my time and have some administrative roles in the medical school. And then another good chunk of my time, I am rebuilding a research program focused on environmental health and asthma disparities.
Wonderful, wonderful. So To start out, how did you end up getting interested in like researching health disparities and the relationships between like social determinants of health, race, and asthma?
So I backed into it from a very naive and ignorant place. And so a long time ago, after I finished my residency, well, I was very interested in critical care and peds hem-onc when I was a resident and loved sort of intensive inpatient medicine and then thought I wanted to do a peds hem-onc fellowship and for a long story decided, no, that I didn't want to do it. So I spent some time working as a general pediatrician and became interested in asthma at that point in time. And around that time, there was a paper published in the New England Journal reporting on an association between cockroach allergen exposure and asthma morbidity. And so I became interested in this concept of exposures. And so I pursued a fellowship, but I didn't come at it at all from a kind of explicit or direct disparities or social determinants point of view. So this was in the early 2000s when I did my fellowship. And what unfolded over time was that, you know, we recognized that mouse infestation and mouse allergen exposure was this major driver of asthma morbidity in Baltimore. And the kids in Baltimore who were going to the ER were predominantly African American. And it became clear sort of over time, you start asking yourself, well, why is there so much mouse infestation? And then I started to understand that my friends who were living in Baltimore City, even in renovated homes, had mouse infestation. And then that starts to really beg the question about that particular kind of environment being related to, you know, historical racism and housing discrimination. And so ultimately, those questions that I started asking sort of landed me in a place of sort of asking, well, why is it that mouse infestation is such a problem in certain neighborhoods? And then I started to learn about the history of housing discrimination.
So what did you end up finding? Like, based on your research, like, what did you end up finding about how housing impacts asthma outcomes and then how that ties in with socioeconomic status and all
right.
that?
Right. So I think, you know, when I entered this area of research, there was a general understanding that housing and housing-related factors were associated with a greater burden of asthma morbidity. I think what was lacking was two things, and they're related. One is sort of the historical understanding of why unhealthy housing was concentrated in neighborhoods that were predominantly of people of color who resided there. So that historical context, I think, for many people, particularly in medical research, was completely unknown. And related to that is there's a distinction that maybe seems nuanced but is really important between studying minority health and studying health disparities. And so even though I think a lot about disparities, most of my work has been focused on within this population that's predominantly African American, what are the major causes of asthma morbidity? To answer a question about disparities, you would have to do a study that compared either racial or ethnic groups, you know, and their exposures to kind of understand. Now, it's sort of implicit that if you look at a map of, and I picked Baltimore because I moved from there a few years ago. But if you look at a map of Baltimore, the areas with the highest burden of asthma are the same areas that were redlined. And those are the same areas that have the most sort of dilapidated and unhealthy housing. And so when you kind of connect all of that evidence, even though it's not explicit and direct about disparities, it kind of points in that direction.
Okay. The term redline, could you define that for those who are listening?
Yes. So redlining comes from maps that were developed in the 1930s that were color-coded based on an assessment of the risk of lending money for to purchase houses or mortgages to people living in that area. And it was largely based on the racial and ethnic composition of those neighborhoods. And so those neighborhoods that were considered high lending risks had red lines drawn around them. And those neighborhoods, the redlining was initially done by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which was a private entity that was kind of an umbrella entity over banks that were mortgage lenders. But that system was adopted by the federal government and by the Federal Government Housing Administration. And so this racist policy became not just something which is problematic in the private sector, but it became embedded in federal government policy.
Going off of that, I saw a lecture you did recently when you talked about that occurring in Austin back in the 1920s, where they zoned certain areas. And I think of East Austin, which the industrial rules were also very lax, and they had increased air population in those areas. So, you know, I'm curious how much of this is in a policy level, which as pediatricians, what can we do to advocate for, like, the zoning rules and industrial air pollution that's affecting certain areas that were historically redlined in this way?
Right. I think the first step is awareness. The second step is, the second point I would make is that there are lots of advocacy opportunities for pediatricians on multiple levels, and you can get involved in local organizations. As one example, there's an environmental health interest group that the medical students have formed, and the Environmental Health Center that I direct, we've sort of facilitated their writing op-eds. We provide scientific oversight. They're very focused on climate change, but there's a lot of need for kind of advocacy work, and there are many channels to do that. There are also implications for the individual patient sitting in front of you. And so if we go back to that example of mouse infestation, if I would see a patient in my clinic who said, yes, I've been having problems with mouse infestation, I'd provide some education, which should be done and is the minimum that needs to be done. But it is woefully insufficient because what I know is that, colleagues of mine who lived in gentrified blocks not far from there and had all the means to address mouse infestation couldn't even do this. So it's easy to sort of lay blame and personal responsibility, at the foot of the parent or the family. When you don't recognize that there are all sorts of structural forces. And so there are ways in those circumstances, there are housing advocacy organizations. We had identified reputable pest management companies that would offer discounts. We had a medical legal partnership. So we, I had a lawyer who did pro bono work where I could refer families to help advocate for either landlords to, address an issue or for them to get support navigating like their long lists, wait lists, but to move to a better housing. So I would write letters if for patients who were struggling with asthma, who also were struggling with home, poor environmental conditions in their home that were contributing. There's another sort of housing movement that has been around for a while called housing mobility. And that's another way that a family can be supported if they're eligible for a federal housing voucher to move from, say, a high poverty neighborhood to an opportunity neighborhood where the housing conditions are better. There is one of those in Baltimore. I don't believe there's a housing mobility program here, but the Austin Tenants Council is a great housing advocacy organization that patients can be referred to. So there are things that you can, first of all, is being educated and being aware. Second of all, finding avenues for advocacy. But then there are things you can do for individual patients and understanding that, particularly for someone my generation, there's so much emphasis on individual responsibility, but understanding and recognizing that there are all sorts of forces that may not be overt or easily seen that limit someone's ability to control their home environment.
Circling the topic back a little bit, one of the, myths that we're trying to address with this podcast is like narratives of like race-based medicine and and like particularly the idea that like there's some like intrinsic characteristic of African-American children that drives them to have worse, particularly pediatric asthma outcomes. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yes. And I think that that view is sort of born out of, you know, the history of this country and how we're acculturated and then our, you know, sort of immediate position of looking at people and taking their physical appearance and then making leaps about, you know, what does that mean? And so if you, you know, work in an emergency room and the majority of kids who come in are African American, you know, for asthma exacerbations, then all of hundreds of years of history and acculturation is brought to bear when you make those observations. And so then you cognitively make this assumption that there must be something inherent to people with darker skin that must explain, you know, why they're in the emergency room so much. And what's amazing is our cognitive biases fight really hard to try to hold on to that. And some examples that I will give are, so even though, as I mentioned, you know, in the 1990s, there was an awareness that housing was an issue, you still to this day can evaluate the literature, and there's still a massive literature that's been desperately hunting for a genetic explanation for asthma disparities. And there's really very little evidence, if any at all, that genetics explains more severe asthma among African Americans. But it's very difficult for humans to disabuse themselves of that notion. And some other examples are, I'll give a concrete example of, there was a paper published pretty recently, and this was a group that had a study population, and they noticed that kids who were Black were like twice as likely to go to the emergency room for asthma. I mean, similar to what's been reported over and over. And so they tried to explain away the difference to see if they could make the difference between Black and white kids in terms of their risk of going to the emergency room, if it went away, if they adjusted for socioeconomic factors. So this was a group that was thinking like, well, this is not inherent to race. This is really inherent to all the experiences that come with race. And so they adjusted for, you know, the income of households in the zip code and a couple of other crude measures. And it reduced the difference between Black and white kids by about 40%, which is a huge amount. But there was still this greater risk going to the ED associated with Black race. But there were all these things they didn't account for, like individual level income, material hardship, psychosocial stress, healthcare access.